If you want to get stuff done, then you have come to the right place. This is the Get Stuff Done podcast, brought to you in association with RDI Worldwide, a weekly interview series with prominent and diverse people from around the world who will share their own unique insights on what it takes to get stuff done and their personal strategies for doing so. My name is Gordon Dudley, the creator of the Get Stuff Done project and host of this podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you enjoy this episode and would love to hear your feedback anytime. Let's get stuff done. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Get Stuff Done podcast. My name is Gordon Dudley, your host, and I am absolutely thrilled to be joined by my guest today, Stefan Rentsch. He's the first German that I have had on the podcast, and he is currently sitting in Germany. And so we're doing this across the world. But a little bit about Stefan. He is a CEO executive with over 25 years of experience. He has been more than 15 years with the German company TÜV SÜD. He has worked in multiple countries, including Korea, which is where we had the first chance to meet some years ago. He's originally an engineer, graduating in mechanical engineering and then also industrial engineering. And I wanted to talk to him and have him on the podcast as a guest because he has been at the forefront of leading large organizations, whilst at the same time always maintaining a very entrepreneurial spirit. So that's, I think, some of the things that we're going to be talking about today. Stefan, thanks so much for being a guest on my podcast.
Thank you, Gordon. That's a lovely introduction. I think the best I've heard about me. So lovely to be here. Unfortunately, it's quite a distance, and you know that I've tried to come back to Korea. It was during just before Corona, and then it hit us. And it's still on my to-do list for sure because I love the country and I miss it also. But
so tell me about the different countries that you've worked in, and maybe add on to that what you perceive to be the most challenging.
Okay, I mean, as you know, I've really traveled. Most continents, Africa, actually, I've not worked in, and not South America, but actually early in my school career, I spent a year in high school in Minnesota, which was lovely and really gave me an introduction to the world, to look beyond your country's borders and really get familiar with the culture. Yeah? And it was absolutely the right thing to do for me. It basically served as a platform later on to travel the world and work in the world. And coming back to Germany, I finished my high school examination there as well. Exams, because the American version is not the equivalent, so you have to go to another 2 years at the time. Luck or fortune, it brought me to London after my studies. Yeah, and my first job was actually in London with PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I got familiar with the English culture, which is, you know, you can see the trails that come to the US, but to really experience the original version was also great. And I loved the culture there, and also, you know, how people meet up in pubs and really communicate a lot, and live music and all of that. I mean, it was a fantastic experience for myself. Although London, of course, is a bit different. I worked also as a student intern more in the Sheffield area, which is more rural and more, I think, more the genuine England than the multicultural London. But
I'm sure you saw a big difference between London and Sheffield. I'm sure.
Absolutely. But both, of course, have something to offer. And what is really interesting is with London is that so many cultures meet and you get a taste of a lot of things in London. It was one of my favorite cities really to live in, except maybe public transport, which was always a challenge at the time, waiting in the subway and the tube. From there, actually, I went back to the US. I lived in California for almost 3 years. I was with a startup and got to know California, which is, again, you know, it's the US, but it's different from Minnesota, of course, quite a bit. It has also already a touch of Asia and Mexico, of course, but lots of Chinese and Japanese people I met there, which love California as well. And a few years later, it brought me back to Germany, where I then stayed for quite a while, from 2003 until 2013. So 10 years in Germany, in various jobs, the last one with TÜV Süd. That was also almost, I had to adopt again to the German culture, being abroad for so long, right?
Reverse culture shock, so to speak.
A little bit, for sure, yeah. One thing, for example, I went to a supermarket in the US, they pack all your stuff, right? At the end of a supermarket, you get everything in bags, and they even ask you if they should support you out to your car. And there I put my stuff on the tray, it was still in the basket. And then the lady looked at me and said, what's wrong, right? And I looked at her, what's wrong? And then I figured out I had to take my stuff out of the basket before she would start charging me for the item. And it was absolutely not with intention, yeah, not being lazy or so.
Right.
Being trained in a certain way was quite interesting. Yeah. And then suddenly having to realize this is no longer here, you have to behave differently.
And I'm sure she was so confused because you're speaking German and clearly German.
She wouldn't understand, like, what I'm, you know, she just thought maybe I'm lazy and I want her to unpack the basket.
Right.
I was at the airport even in Munich, you know, where a lot of different cultures meet, of course, and go shopping. But anyway, that was like a wake up for me to understand you are here in Germany again and it's different. I lived really a good time in Munich. It's a lovely city, also big enough to have a bit of a mix, and then the Alps nearby. And I stayed there until 2013. I was always interested to work and live in Asia. Originally, the plan was to go to China because for obvious reasons, all the growth, the big hype was about China. So that was my first intention, but we had already a good management team in China. So within the company, it was not possible to transfer so easily. And then by luck, the CEO in Korea left. And then I just asked, you know, could I throw my hat into the basket and see if I'm a good fit for that. And fortunately enough, I got the role and stayed there almost 6 years, yeah, before coming back to Europe. So, and actually now I'm living in Austria still, which is another culture again. And then, of course, Austria is a tiny country with lots of different, let's say, areas of culture. You know, Vienna is, okay, was a big city compared to the rest of Austria. But, you know, you drive 50, 80 kilometers away and you have a different mindset, a different culture there. And that's also interesting to see how quickly things change, you know. And then in my role as CEO for Central and Eastern Europe, I got to know a lot of the smaller Central and Eastern European countries, which some of them I have never been before. It was quite interesting to see, you know, how they have changed or how they are still maybe in their individual nationalistic, behavior. Some of them are still, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the Polish
country
was the most interesting for me to see how entrepreneurial and open-minded they go about business and taking the benefit out of being part of the European Union. That was quite positive, I must say, to see that.
Yeah, I definitely think sometimes there is an assumption that all of Europe is the same. There is a lot of proximity, and you can visit three countries, four countries in a day by easily driving around. But that doesn't mean that they're the same. And there is, you know, a huge amount of diversity and variety, even within a very small space. Yeah. So 2013 was when you first came over to Korea and were then working. Now you moved, you were with the same company. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it was the same, it was the same organization, but it was a different branch. And some of the international companies that I've worked with in the past try very hard to make there be a similar feel, a similar culture in all of their branches as much as possible. So that in a sense, whether you're in the branch in Korea or Afghanistan, America, or Bolivia, you can feel that this is the same company. Was that the case for you when you first came to the Korea branch?
To be open, no, it was not. It was very, very Korean in a way. So it felt foreign, really, alien to me. I was the alien, but the whole environment was somewhat alien to me. And I think one of the observations I had at the beginning was that communication was difficult, not just the language barrier, but you with the status of a boss, really boss, they call it boss. China uses it more than Korea, but my boss basically was a way of showing actually respect, and not just hierarchy, but it was not easy to chat, to just have open conversations with all the staff members. What you had to basically build first was a certain layer of trust and also engagement with the culture. And also, I think because of previous issues within the company, they had to go through a, let's say, cultural journey of finding themselves, what they really wanted to be. The old Korean hierarchical structure of organization, or a more open-minded, younger minded cultural setup. And that was actually a journey I was experienced over the 5-6 years I was there, towards a different touch and feel, I would say. But yeah, it was first it was like, woo. How do I connect here?
Right. And was that something that you had external support to do? Or was it something that you had to just kind of work your own way, find your own way of
getting? Yeah, I mean, I think there was not such a program to prepare yourself for couple of years in Korea from the headquarters, for example. I think they originally had one German CEO running the country. Normally, that was the first Korean that was running it for a while. And before, they basically brought German management in, but the rest of the company was fully Korean. And I think one of the things that we started, and I think it was very successful, is besides bringing German and other international team members to Korea for the first time for a longer time of not just a business trip, but for really working and living there, we brought the first Koreans from our team to suit offices in other parts of the world to basically start that exchange and understanding, because I think that's basically communication is about finding things that are common, right? To have a common base, and that really worked well and brought also interest and curiosity out there to explore things outside of Korea within the big German two-suit organization, which has offices everywhere, right? And also bringing them closer to the colleagues in Japan and China, which were also improved dramatically. The best thing was a football match between Korea and China. that was a fantastic event in China.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. Yeah. It's not something that you do. And I'm sure that there is so much more that was achieved in communication and relationship building than having a meeting or a dinner with drinks, right? And I'm sure that, you obviously have a clear memory of that. I'm sure many other colleagues still do. Maybe just for those of you who are not familiar with the company, Tuvsud, it has well over 100-year history, is a fantastic example of longevity and growth. It's, I mean, it's in so many different sectors. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell everybody who's maybe not familiar exactly the type of business that Tüv-Süd is?
Yeah, it's closer to 200 years than 100 years now. In 1866, it was founded, actually. Originally, it came from the area of Industrial Revolution, when you had the steam engines or steam boilers, and the issues with that technology to protect basically people, the environment, and property from risks of technology. This is where Tüv-Süd originated, in Mannheim, actually, in a beer brewery, where engineers came together and formed an association to have that mission. And that's still the mission of today, with all the new technologies and the new advancements in digital and AI and all these issues that come along. I think Tüv-Süd is well prepared to also be of service to companies and people in general, because we not only service directly companies, but indirectly, you know, when products get certified, the end customer basically gets the result into their hands, including mobile phones or computers and right. hair dryers. All of those are generally tested according to national legislation. And the European Union has, for example, a very standardized view on things, how to bring them into the countries. And so that's an interesting business. Tüv-Süd in Korea was founded in 92-93 time frame. So also quite a while ago. As an affiliate office
and
beginning,
Right. And so then in the UK, at least where I'm from, the Tüv test is one of the famous, like, well known things for the everyday person on the street with regards to the automotive side of things. But I remember. But so
in
then
Germany everyone knows us by the
everyone knows. Okay.
Right? Because as a student with your old car, first thing is, oh, do I get through with that old car? Do I get permission to run for another 2 years?
Yeah. But the thing which a lot of global companies tend to say is one of the more challenging things of doing business in Korea is regulation. And in fact, Tüv-Süd is almost immersed in the business of regulation in terms of being able to, like you said, about the standardization of it and the certification of it.
Yeah.
Is that therefore then an opportunity, a specific opportunity for a global business in Korea, or was it very much a challenge because of that?
I think it's both, as you say it, right? I mean, first of all, okay. Korean products also, it's a very export-oriented country. So most of the products produced in Korea leave the country and go global, right? So I think from that point of view, it's an ideal point to be there as a German entity that does testing, inspection, certification of products that go, for example, to the US or Europe. Yeah. And this is, I think, the prime role we had at the beginning. And later, we also supported international companies selling into Korea with local acceptance testing and the likes. But a lot of this is still regulated by Korean legislation. I'm not up to date what has changed recently, but at the time, you had to also partner with local European labs, most of them government-owned, the large players. And so basically, we had kind of partnership agreements about which direction the product comes, right? Does it leave the country or does it come in? And that's basically prohibiting also in somewhat easy trade. And of course, there's a lot of effort in the world to harmonize that. For example, Israel recently adopted a lot of the EU regulation for bringing products into the country to make it easier and faster and less expensive. Because if a product has passed, for example, EU standards regulation, then why not trust it and use it also in Israel?
Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. I want to come back to the event or the program that brought us together. And I full credit to you, Stefan, because you were the one who actually reminded me that it was not through our direct business working relationship that we first met, but it was actually through a Korean government program called K-Mentors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I was just wondering, where was it, at one of the European get-togethers, which we had lots of them, but no, I think we met as mentors in that program.
Yeah. Indeed, indeed. And so that program was trying to bring together people like yourself and myself with global experience, with international careers of various backgrounds to try to help young Koreans to forge more successful careers in global companies in Korea, but also maybe to pursue also international careers. So I think at one point I had four or five mentees at the same time. But as you know, there's always somebody who jumps right in and takes full advantage of the program and gets all that they can. And then there's the other person who just signed up because somebody told them to do so.
Sure.
That was a great way to meet you, first of all. And it seems that that type of thing is something that is important to you, and you have a passion for that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I was lucky enough to get a very talented young female engineer that was currently at the time still engaged in China with a Korean company. And she just wanted to come back and was a bit scared to face the local Korean labor market, because at least at the time, it was difficult to find jobs for younger professionals, and might still be the case today. So she was signing up for it, and I mean, she got a job before we really went through the third month of mentoring. She was just a great talent, a personality which was open-minded, curious, and just picked my brain to learn a little bit from my experience that could help her in her job. And she joined actually a French company, a global player in electronics that had a big presence also in Korea. And it was a lot of fun. And at the same time, I didn't take on that many like you, because we had also internal mentoring programs, not only within our organization in Korea, but also within the global and Southeast Asian, or at least Asia Pacific region, where we continuously did mentoring programs every 1 or 2 years with people from executive management training programs. That was a lot of fun, and you learn over time, but it really depends on how this get together works out in the end, because you meet already at that time a lot online. It was not always a physical presence. So you had your video conference calls or telephone calls, and with some it worked excellently, and they really, you could see how they were going through their career, moving up, and being very thankful. That's also fun, to get this feedback in the end about helping others, and passing on some thoughts, or just helping them actually to use what they have already, internally.
Sure.
And then just
sure.
Not sure enough how to use it or how to trust their own thoughts, So it's really an interesting, part of business management life, and continued this also in Central and Eastern Europe, of course.
I don't know, I have no idea whether the program is still going or not, but to any of the K-Move mentors of the past or the current, a big shout out to you. Hope that you're all doing well.
Building on that, contact with that lady. I mean, she still writes to me sometimes, how are you? And others in Tupsuda are also doing this still. So it's fun, And then you see where they are, how they progress. So it's fun. Yeah. But the mentors, you're the only one that I have still contact with, actually.
The other mentors. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe this podcast will bring somebody out from the bus. Let's see. I wanted to move from mentoring into, you know, the more formal leadership roles that you have. And, you know, most recently, you've been in charge of, I think, 1,400 staff based across 10 different countries. Mm-hmm. What is it like to have that kind of responsibility? And how do you kind of approach that and try to make that work to be as effective as possible?
I mean, I was lucky to take on the role before the corona wave hit us, yeah, because I think, first of all, is traveling, listening, observing, and getting to know the people. I think that's always a good recipe.
Face-to-face.
Just face-to-face, like, be there physically from, you know, morning till evening, just to see the whole part of business life, including dinners and drinks. Just to get familiar with the culture, this is not done within one day. You know, it takes quite a while. Sometimes it goes faster. It depends on which personalities you meet, because they have outgoing personalities and introvert. You know, like in any country, you find different people, and that is generally. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's easier to talk to someone who's more extrovert and loves to engage and get to know things and is curious in terms of his or her presence. But generally, it was traveling, getting to know, and also being part of some of the company meetings, company events. I participate, for example, in company team buildings. That was, for me, also one of the first things. I think it was a goulash tournament, you know, cooking tournament. And that was so much fun to then also sample the great results and to see how the little teams formed and had all their secret recipes. And it was splendid weather. It was super nice, warm. That was in Hungary. And my mother is Hungarian, so for me, this was very special to be there. Other things we had, you know, some have big parties from the company or create one or two days offsites even where they go somewhere and just participate in these events to get to know people. That was very important, because then suddenly it hit us and we couldn't travel anymore. I took the last train from Prague back to Austria and then they closed the border. I mean, that's how serious it was. We never had that in our life before, you know. Suddenly being shut off and not coming back. So I was happy to be on that train. And then we were virtual. Thanks to that, we could still communicate and it worked quite well. I was astonished how once you have your relationships built up, how well that works. And maybe your question about different cultures, yes, they are different cultures and you need to respect that. So even within the groups, within one country, you have different age groups. And I think you're quite familiar that in Korea, you have big differences in cultural habits and behaviors between younger generations and the more older, more senior ones. And they don't always mix well. And that's the same, I think, in Europe to some or less degree, I would say. So you have to be adaptive, whom you meet and what their interests are.
So how would you summarize your leadership style, would you say?
It's evolving because I think...
Constantly.
Constantly. Okay. You think that it's something that you have fixed. I would say it's a flow of being a leader and learning to adapt to new environments, new situations. I think you have to be extremely observative and curious to learn about other views, to integrate this into what you do, because you need feedback loops. And I think feedback loops are an important part of leadership, is that you also ask the question, what do you think about this or that? And also to correct if something doesn't go according to your own perspective, you know, that you take different angles at what you do and how you lead. Generally speaking, there's no simple recipe. You know, some people like more direct, procedures where they know what they have to do. They don't want that flexibility. They don't want to think about what to do. They just want to have a list to work according to. And others want exactly the opposite. They want room for creativity, for trying things out. I prefer working with that kind of, let's say, leadership culture where you work with people that you just make sure they have enough skills to do what they are asked to do, and then give them a lot of room and flexibility to figure it out with your guidance, but not with your, daily control. So this this is much more efficient in the end, also as a manager, to enable them to do the job rather than you telling them what to do. But of course, two cultures, different environments require a mix of different leadership tools, I would say. And also building a culture that is used to being open and flexible and trusting people, enabling people. You know, you cannot just start from day one when they're used to being order-driven, let's say, organizations through a now you are in charge culture. This is clearly a cultural shock also to some of the organizations that I was managing. And it's a painful process to change, because it requires normally also change in habits, sometimes even in people, because it just doesn't work with a certain set of people that it clashes completely. And then they normally opt out. They don't want that anymore and they leave. Instead of you having to ask them to leave, they say, this is not the company I know. I don't want that. I want this and that. And then basically you have to figure out how to make it work in a new way and find engineers or staff that is able to pick it up.
Right. Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that a lot of the success of that change process is predicated on the preparation and the communication up front that this is going to happen and how it's going to be, and that there will be a change process rather than simply initiating it. And then, as you say, then there's a big...
It's a journey. Even in Korea, it was a big, long journey, and a journey, and I think it's still going on, what I heard. You start a movement of change and being adaptive. And I think this is what this ever-changing, faster-changing world requires, is to being adaptive, to change, to learn, to be curious, and to also ask yourself, but also your staff and whoever surrounds you for feedback. Is it still the right thing we are doing? Do we do it the right way? Or should we use a different method? Should we use, for example, technology now, which I see is coming in heavily, is new tech, in sort of AI tools, things that can help you to do the things much faster and also more accurate and more consistent.
I think you've touched on and highlighted perhaps a very underrated element of work, and especially of leadership, which is the curiosity element. Mm-hmm. I think that with a curiosity, like you said, in the person, in their individual circumstances, in that person, what they want, what they like, what works for them, and then also in to always be asking the right questions as well, in the right kind of way, I think that's very important, and yet not talked about so much. I think that is an underrated element of the kind of, let's call it, the leadership toolkit. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you mentioned that.
I think we have to add to another C word to that, is courage, because when you touch something to change it, it's of course a risk. It's always a risk to touch something and change it, and there are reactions in the organization. I said to you earlier, maybe a very senior, very important engineer leaves the company because they don't like that new path of culture and values the company is going. So you pay a price for that change process, and you have to basically judge, do we stay in the old system? Do we keep it running because it is producing cash and it's doing well? Or do we need to change because otherwise we will die later and then completely? So when do we start that change process? And do we have enough courage and also endurance to go through that cycle of pain, which normally change means? You know, it's not only fun. At the beginning, it's more painful. Later, it becomes fun. It can be also fun at the beginning when you kick it off and brainstorm because there's no price to pay yet. It's just a thought. Then you start implementing. Then it starts to become more painful. You go into the cycle of, do I do the right thing and the valley of pain. And then you climb the hill of productivity and fun again. And then you reach new heights. But it's clearly a journey and a roller coaster ride for sure.
Where and how did you develop the courage to do these kind of things?
I think it's maybe because I've traveled so much, maybe I've tried so many things that I've seen that even though you change an environment, you can still make it work. I was, for example, early in my career as a student in school, I changed 6 or 7 times high schools and grammar schools and all of that. Because my parents moved, my father was a professor at different university hospitals and universities, and so in my first 4 years, I think I had 3 or 4 moves, and then the new kid on the block has to adapt to a new environment, whereas you meet an established environment, right? And at beginning you may find 1 or 2 friends, but not everyone will be like, oh great, you come and here you are. You're normally having an issue also to integrate at the beginning, and this is exactly I think how it is with bringing change into a company. Is you have maybe 2 or 3 believers that or people that see it, not only believers, but they know that it's the right thing to do, and these people you have to bring behind into your team because they help you to leverage it into the organization. And this is a leverage effect into the company, infiltrating the next person and the next person. And then you have people that only after a few years come back to you and say, wow, we did the right thing. But I didn't believe it. And for 2-3 years, they would be opposing what you tried to do. And then 3 years later, one of the biggest compliments you get is like, wow, we did the right thing. Just, for example, the office move in Korea, you know, we moved that new building because I wanted to basically initiate a new step, a new chapter in the book of our organization in Korea, to bring everyone onto one floor, to bring people from different teams together because they didn't even know each other, and to create a one company feeling. And a lot of people didn't want to even move these 2 kilometers, you know, but thanks God they both had a good subway connection. And of course the new office was much better than the old one on 2 different floors in a very old style building with, also the feeling was, dull and gray in that building. You know, it was once, I think, a highlight as a building structure in Korea, but that was in the 1988s for the Olympics, a long time ago, right? So, interesting experiences. I think coming back, courage. I think knowing that that it works if you try hard, knowing also that things can go wrong, but being in charge of adapting again to make sure it works in the end. That's important. And I think this basically requires experience, having gone through the process of learning that it can be done. And then you trust yourself that I can do it. And being positive minded, I think you just have to believe also into what you do, because you can have hit backs that are tough to digest, right? And then continue going. It's important. Don't give up.
What would you say was the biggest setback that you faced in your 20 plus year career so far? How did you?
I think That's not easy because, of course, there are always some. But I think the first that came up now to my mind, I never thought about this for a long time. But I think to have a business fold, you know, go bankrupt. We had that in the startup, which I joined in the 2000s in California. And it was such a shame because such a great idea. Also, the product wasn't bad at the time, but we were, timing was bad. Maybe also we over-engineered it. So today you have this lean startup approach where you test your products very early on to get the customer feedback into the loop before you over-engineer something and you run out of money. But it was painful because it was a lovely team. It was a great product. And then being in charge of folding this and filing bankruptcy, that was not easy. Also because I had to deal as a CFO at the time with all the legal topics on that in Germany, because it was financed through Germany, through banks and equity. That was certainly one of the toughest times, because also afterwards it was difficult to find a job, actually, because many people said, you've been a board member, a managing director, CFO with 33 years, you know, you're overqualified. We don't need you here, basically. Yeah. To find back into the industry, it wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
That was
tough. Evidently a very meaningful experience for you that I think has clearly shaped your journey. We've been able to go 40 minutes into the podcast interview, and I haven't yet asked my key go-to question that I ask all my guests, which is around getting stuff done.
Right.
So, Stefan, tell us about how you get stuff done. Maybe some of your personal, you know, tips, tricks, secret strategies, whatever you want to call them, techniques, things you learn along the way, which allow you to get stuff done and that you really put into practice.
Right. I mean, first of all, I think you have to stand back from let's say your tasks, from your issues, from your priorities, and for example, you can do jogging, go mountain biking, do some meditation to basically clear your brain, to see through the forest of topics, ideas, problems, issues. I mean, it's when you're in management with lots of people around you, you are faced with multiple topics you can deal with, right? And then my topic was always, how do I prioritize? And how do I, find also the way where I am needed and where others can do, for example, the things, or what you can also delay and see how it will evolve. Sometimes it's good to just observe for a while to see if the solution doesn't come along by itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're always overtasked. You have always too much to do. And it's very important to find a way to deal with that. And I think it's to filter and to find really the essence of topics of importance that is meaningful to the organization and to your vision and tasks, right? The next area, I think, is to enable your organization to share the workload as a CEO, for example, which is an endless big list of things, and to find talented people that can take over some of these tasks and to lead them and bring them to the next level, and you're just a mentor and not directly involved doing them. So I think when you have a large organization, it's always to see how to enable the organization to deal with its tasks and what's really left on your own list. So this for me was also why mentoring and coaching is so important, is to bring up the people to basically do things you could do or they can do. Yeah. And that was absolutely an important topic to get more agile and to get more things done as an organization, and which also needed this cultural change I was mentioning of not saying the CEO, what do we do, but asking them, okay, do you take part of this issue? Will you be in charge, for example, for Eastern Europe for this specific topic? And what would be your way to find a strategy forward for us to thrive in that market and with the workforce we have? Because one of the, I think, things we did move in the last couple of years was to build teams across the borders, not just to look at your market as a country border, but to really see which experts you can utilize across the borders and to build a team and a cluster of people to work on a specific area of the industry. It was in parts already set up before I came. It was country clusters, so 2-3 countries working together, but this not really was thriving well. And also it was, missing out on this synergy that you have when you bring teams together. And that's what we did. We basically promoted a team in hydrogen, for example, across all the borders. And we had different expert hubs in Austria and in Poland, for example. And for the project business, we have lots of competence in Turkey, where we brought in that competence to basically try to build an organization about staffing and running larger scale projects, because you need to have competences that are fit to this kind of specific task list. It's not a daily job. It's for a few months, maybe for a few years, you do a specific topic and you need different skills. So in general, I think for yourself, it's important to unclutter your mind, to see through what is really important, and to also have a rhythm of checking back on that. Are you still on track? So basically you set yourself priorities, tasks, timelines, right? And then you have to regularly review them, best of course weekly. Daily doesn't make sense, but on a weekly basis to remind yourself what was the priority last week, last month. Did I achieve my milestones for the 3 months, 6 months that I set up? Where did it go well and where not? And also find out why sometimes things deviate over your original plans.
Okay. What would be one very specific example of a tool, a method, a technique, whatever you want to call it, that you use that's really effective and helpful for you?
I mean, there's lots of things. It depends on let's say, if we do a new project, right? I think the lean startup approach is to plan out a new project, new, let's say, service offering you are trying to launch, and to basically fill it according to this structure and to then challenge it is very, very helpful, starting a business. It's also important to basically look through the elements of a business plan. You have the market side, you have the customer side. So basically it helps you to structure your issues or thoughts about who is the team, how much money do I need for that? So a financial plan has to be created. You need to think things through in order to get a heads up on where you're heading and what it takes. So you're also able to communicate early on to let's say your funding organization, I need 2 million, I need 3 million, that's important. So because I've done quite a few startups, this was always important to look at the complete picture, not just the service offering, not just the team, but the entire circle of stakeholders, and also the funding is quite important. On things that are running well, where an engineer, a senior engineer, has its customers or her customers, they know what to do when the customers are calling, so it's not so difficult to manage that part. But we don't have so much recurring business, partly it is and partly it's project business, and winning project business is okay. How do you set up an effective sales approach? How do you use that? And where do you get your leads from? That was also important to basically look into organization effectiveness, right?
And so, a lot of people, perhaps maybe not majority, but a significant minority of people aspire to be a CEO. Mm-hmm. If there is someone who is listening or watching this podcast who has that desire, has that goal, would like to be a CEO in the future, what would be the thing that you would say to them to focus on, or something which maybe they should work on, or maybe, since we always talk about transferable skills in the Get Stuff Done project, what would be the most transferable, highly sought after transferable skill required to be an effective CEO, in your opinion?
I think what comes to my mind first of all is to be able to make decisions, and sometimes even quick decisions when you don't have enough time, but you need to make a decision, which then requires courage, because you don't know what you're getting into. Some things is uncertain. So you have to be able to deal with uncertainty and manage that, and not knowing exactly mm-hmm. how things go. Yeah. So, and that means to okay. take on also that responsibility on your shoulders, and to be able to bear the heavy burden of sometimes things that don't go so well. It's easy to carry the burden of something that goes very well, because there is no burden. Actually, there's fame and applause, right? But in many sure. situations in business, you don't have the sunny side always. So that is part mm-hmm. of it. Okay. I think you have to also have a curiosity in mind to also work on strategy, on how to reach okay. a goal, you know. I think you have to also love to work with people, different people, because I think the diversity in a team is absolutely key to the success. If you have always the same characters in your team, the same skills, you won't make it anywhere normally. Yeah? So I think to find the right mix of culture, but also of views, it's always good to have someone who is critical in the team, right? Who's not always says, great CEO, you have the wonderful idea, let's follow it, but saying, have you thought about this or that? That's analytical people, you know, that sometimes bring right. you back on earth when you have something where you think this is the next, rocket to the moon, you know?
Sure. So sure.
That's yep. important.
Yep.
But generally, it's being able to make decisions in uncertain environments, and also being able to take that responsibility. Quite a few people struggle with that. Okay. They just don't like to take responsibility, mm-hmm. but they can be extremely good advisors to you, wingmen, women in your team that basically help you shoulder it. And what we try to avoid is mistakes, right? So to mm-hmm. What you knowingly can avoid by using good thoughts, a good team of analytics, of different angles of viewing things, that's important for me. And mm-hmm. this helps also to be a CEO, because a CEO, even though sometimes you're lonely because you're the person that took the decision, it's important to have the right team around you to actually also be successful as a CEO. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So choose your team wisely, if you can.
Choose your team wisely. I think there's just been an absolute ton of wisdom shared and insights given in this chat today that we've had in this episode. Stefan, thank you so much for sharing some of your insights and your experiences that you've acquired by having curiosity and by having courage, and also the responsibility that you also mentioned at the end. Thank you so much for being my guest. Absolutely. And also thank you to everybody for being with us on this episode. If you have been watching on YouTube, you can also get a hold of the audio versions available on all the major podcast channels. If you've been only listening, there is also a video version available at Get Stuff Done Gordon on YouTube. I would be extremely honored if you would go so far as to subscribe, so that you can keep in touch with all of the episodes as they come up, so that you may be able to get every episode as it comes out. Once again, thank you so much, and let's get stuff.
Thank you for listening to the Get Stuff Done podcast. If you would like to be a guest in the future, please do reach out.
or if you would like to recommend someone, that would be awesome as well. Make sure you keep listening, as we will be bringing you fresh insights every week, because getting stuff done is something everyone needs.